Shopping Maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave V.F. Rupert, and with me is Chris V.L. Squire. How are you today, Chris?
Dang it, I was just looking up Vue API stuff because I knew you were going to do it. It was going to be like on component loaded coyer or whatever, but that's
at
not one
click. We got all kinds of directives, but hey, directive me to the person we're talking to today, Chris.
Well, we have the creator of Vue himself, Evan Yu, on. Hey, Evan, how are you doing?
Great. How are you?
Good. Good. We were excited to get you because we have been doing a bit of a mini series here. I'll publish that on Shop Talk Show soon, where we kind of collect a couple of different shows that represent JavaScript in 2021, because it's just been wild. Last time we did that was in 2019. And if you look at what was happening in JavaScript in 2019, there was plenty of exciting stuff. And the story's like totally different now. There's just a lot more players, a lot more interesting things happening, thanks to changes in the ecosystem and people just doing interesting things, period. And certainly the kind of quote-unquote bundler market is a part of that. I say quote-unquote because it's kind of like some of these new tools are like not really bundlers or on purposely avoid the concept of bundling. And bundling is what it says on the box, right? Taking files and combining them together. A tool that on purpose kind of doesn't do that, at least in development, is Vite. And it's got lots of press and people excited about it. Dave, you're using it on a project, right?
I'm using it. I probably poorly explained it here a half a dozen times, so I'm glad you're here, Evan, to explain it better.
I'd love to just start with that, because it's called Vite. The tagline is next generation front end tooling. Mm-hmm. Rather than us explain it, can you do it? I know you've done this before in talks and stuff, but let's do it on the show.
Sure. Actually, every time people ask me what it exactly is, like, I find a hard time to find, you know, an existing equivalent, because it's a little bit different in everything it does to like something we're familiar with. Like, say, I think the closest resemblance to an existing tool is Parcel, which So Parcel is this. If we look at all the whole bundler scene from the beginning, it's Browserify to Gulp. It really isn't a bundler, right? It's just a build tool. But then
you have to tell it to bundle. You're right.
Right, but then we have like Browserify, Webpack, Rollup, Parcel. Right. And these bundlers, they kind of all have a little bit of different abstraction levels. But Parcel is one of the most, I would say, the scope is the widest. It covers the most features out of the box. And it also also try to encourage you to use the HTML as your application's entry point. So which is a concept that Vite aligns with as well. The biggest difference, obviously, is in that Vite really is not a bundler in this sense. So if we think about a build tool, right? So I use a very generic term, build tool, because when we work on a modern front-end project, there's always some sort of compiling going on. Sometimes we use, you know, we need to compile templates, or we need to compile JSX or TypeScript, right? There's always some compiling going on. This is unavoidable. But traditional bundlers do this transformation step as part of the bundling pipeline, right? So it transforms everything first, then put everything back together into a single JavaScript file. Then you serve it to the browser. And we do this for both development and production. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one thing we've realized is with native ES modules, the browser has come to have the capability of just serving ES modules as is. And it's pretty fast, pretty performant. For local development, you can serve several hundred modules, well within a second. So if you have several hundred modules and the bundler have to put them together, sometimes it takes even longer. Right, we've all been through with Webpack some of those Webpack days where everyone probably has worked at least on one project that takes like 2 minutes to start up. So it's kind of been a common experience. And like we in the Vue ecosystem, we've heard a lot about that as well, because like Vue CLI is based on Webpack. You know, I don't want to knock on Webpack because, you know, it's been a great advancement in front-end tooling, right? It's a great achievement. But the experience we've had is we have a lot of users who have huge projects, and they're like, oh, my project takes like 2 minutes to start up, and every hot module replacement takes like 3 seconds, ooh, right? This whole feedback loop is just is getting brutal. Like if you're just trying to make a simple change, and you have to wait like several seconds for something to update on every change.
No good. So is that the core thing? Is the core thing, let's stop bundling in development? Is that the biggest part?
The core thing is there a way to do less during development and get closer to leverage more what, you know, some of the capabilities that we expect in the pure bundler era is that the browser is kind of dumb. It can only, you know, handle simple script tags. It only has global scope. So we have to do everything, handle all the module stuff before we send anything to the browser, right? But now the browser has a module system. So how about we just let the browser do that, right? So our tooling can actually do less and focus just on transforming only if necessary, actually, right? If you're writing modern JavaScript, you're targeting modern browsers, in a lot of cases, you don't even need to transpile, right? So if we just like, I guess the premise is if we, assume that the browser is now much more capable, assume you're writing modern JavaScript, what can we throw away in our dev workflow and just like, you know, boil it down to the, you know, the bare minimum, the actual features that we care about, like being able to import from an NPM dependency, like being able to just, you know, have TypeScript just work. Being able to have a plugin system where it's, you know, straightforward to say, use this plugin and you got Vue working. Use this plugin and you got React Refresh working, right? So that's the idea, right? Because we've seen that a lot of the, I mean, I've personally worked on higher level tooling on top of Webpack, and it's complicated as hell. So at the same time, I keep thinking like, you know, all these things we've been doing, if I just, you know, write it. So given there's a module system in the browser already, I can probably simplify this by a whole lot. So that's kind of the driving idea behind it when I first started experimenting with the idea.
And it just you lucked out in a way that browsers and ES modules is super fast. It just happens to be fast, which is nice. If it wasn't fast, maybe this wouldn't
definitely
work.
Definitely.
And you even said the metrics are, you can even get up to hundreds, you were saying, hundreds of modules, and it's still fast, still good.
So yeah, there are a lot of optimizations you actually have to do to avoid there are having too many modules. Most importantly, because you're still sort of fetching these modules over HTTP, right? So every request has an overhead. In local development, I mean, even if you use HTTP2, I mean, an actual request is still a lot more overhead than, you know, just reading from disk directly. But typically, we can get the total count of modules down to a reasonable amount where even for huge projects that we've tested in real world, it's still overall a better experience than, say, the Webpack equivalent.
So I'm curious that if in dev, not bundling and leaning on ESM is so fast, why not production then too? Why does it have to be a different story for production at all?
So for production, the story is network latency, right? That's the whole difference. Because you're doing local development, there's literally no latency at all. Right, everything is on your disk. So, but if you ship this to production, then you have a whole different category of problems. First is the chained network waterfall, because you will have ES modules that A imports B imports C. So the way it works right now is if you don't have any sort of resource prefetching hints, the browser will just fetch A Once A is fetched, then it parses it, then realize, oh, I need B. Then it parses B, right. Then it fetches C, right? So it creates
the waterfall. Yeah.
And the waterfall kind of compounds, you know, with the latency. So if you are on a slow network on a phone, you know, this just causes a lot of problems. And you have to, you know, optimizing this is sort of tedious. It has to do a lot with, you know, I don't think there's really mature ways to completely automate this yet, even with HTTP2. Another aspect of this is caching, because individual module caching is sort of, it's kind of a dilemma, because you either fingerprint these files or you don't. And if you don't, then you can't really cache it locally. You cannot use strong cache headers. You have to always hit the server to revalidate. But if you fingerprint, then you're essentially involving a build process, which is actually also pretty complicated.
Yeah, you'd think you'd have to change the actual HTML that's requesting it, or this script. Push those? Do you unwaterfall the waterfall in dev? Do you just like smash all the imports up to the top level and let them all happen at once?
So the waterfall is actually almost negligible during dev, because typically it's only a few levels deep, right? And because it's local, you know, the latency is literally like 1 millisecond. So in most cases, you won't even notice it. But, you know, in production environments on a phone, it can be up to a second or 2 seconds. And that can be pretty brutal.
And there's no, that's not going to change in the next anywhere near soon, right? Like network latency is just a fact of life. It's physics.
Right? Yeah. And it depends on what market you're targeting. I mean, if you're like targeting pure 5G, it's probably better, you know. But if you're targeting, you know, developing countries with slow networks providers, then it's a whole different story.
So it seems like that'll be true for, I don't know, at least a while, that, you know, don't bundle in dev, bundle in production. So Vite seems well placed for, you know, years to come for the...
There are obviously, you know, folks working on the platform, the web platform, hoping to enable, you know, production capable unbundled delivery. So I think one thing that import map kind of has to play with that a little bit.
Import view from view is invalid ESM, right? Is the problem?
Yeah, that's one thing though. Import map also kind of helps with caching.
Because
you can actually move the fingerprinting process into the import map. So let's say you have A and B,
really?
C.
Cool.
Right?
Yeah.
So your files can remain non-fingerprinted, but you move the fingerprinting into the import map. So the import map is in your HTML. So you request the HTML, which always revalidates, but then the import map will actually fetch different resources.
It reminds me of service workers, how you have to ship a new service worker when you invalidate certain caches and stuff.
Yeah, but I guess everything is simpler than service workers.
Everything is simpler, though. That's what we'll call this episode. no, probably not. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by WooCommerce. WooCommerce is a e-commerce plugin for your WordPress site. Super, super popular. I'm sure partly due because WordPress is really popular, but also because it's awesome. It's like a really good e-commerce plugin that you can do tons of stuff with. I use it. I've used it a bunch in the past. I'm using it right now as the store on CSS Tricks, which is probably not like, it's not like one of these stores that has like 10,000 projects and I don't know. It's not like exactly stretching the limits of what WooCommerce can do, but it does do one cool thing. Well, whatever. It does a bunch of cool things actually. But one is for actual physical products I sell from it, right? I sell digital stuff too, but it's, you know, we make like some posters that get printed and sold, and a sweatshirt, which is a very nice sweatshirt that I think is cool. But I don't like have a bunch of pre-printed sweatshirts here in my office that I package up and send to you when you order it. I could set it up that way. That'd be no problem, but I was hoping for easier. So one of the things I do is use a print-on-demand service. The one I happen to use is Printify, which I think is fine. They do okay, you know, but there's other versions of it. They're not the sponsor here. It's about WooCommerce. But what's cool is that the integration is so tight. So like you order from my store and you never leave my store and a poster or a sweatshirt or whatever shows up at your door thanks to the integration, which is pretty cool. There's a thing I had to troubleshoot the other day that was like weird on it. Is that I thought that, you know, it would be nice if people got shipment notifications, you know, but that would be like Printify's job for sending it, you know, not WooCommerce. It doesn't know when it sends, you know, and I just had a setting wrong. So if this ever happens to you, please reach out to me because I will fix it for you. But there's an aspect of WooCommerce where you can add notes to an order after it's done. And there's all kinds of different types of notes that have like different colors. This one, and then there's a setting that says, do you want to email the customer when you update the order with a note of this type? And I had it to off for who knows what reason, but Printify did actually the smart thing where they would update the order with the tracking information for the order. And it just wasn't working. And then that's when I found the setting and I flipped it on and oh, thank God. Now all my customers, when they order something, you get an email about your order that has the tracking information the second it ships. And it just feels so satisfying to have that solved. So thank you, WooCommerce, for making that ability nice. Very cool. So, Adam, there's so many aspects of this. Speed being one of them, you know, it's not just this, just leaning on ESM locally, right? There's also like this, everybody's, other than Veet, everybody's favorite thing is ES Build, and you're leveraging mm-hmm. that too, right? So, you're buying some of the speed from the fact that Go is involved.
Yeah, ES Build is definitely a big factor in what makes Veet fast. So the idea, so going back to our previous idea, you know, going full unbundled. So Veet isn't truly full unbundled. Let's imagine you have these ES module dependencies like Lodash.es, right? This module alone, if you import it, just, you know, import using a named import, like import debounce from Lodash. This thing alone is going to pull in 600 modules. Because the main entry points of Lodash.es actually imports every single utility it contains inside of it. So sadly, the browser doesn't really know how to do tree shaking. So essentially, it has to like just parse and fetch everything, which... You know, in my early testing, when I was testing out the idea, I was like, what happens if I import Lodash.es? And it takes like a whole second for the page to load by just importing it, right? So that's obviously not ideal.
So who's tree shaking? Is ES Build tree shaking or is it your own magic, Veet's magic?
So there is actually no need to do tree shaking, but we need to do pre-bundling. So the idea is we squash all these 600 ES Lodash.es modules into one thing, right? So people will be like, oh, well, now we're going back to bundling, right? But the idea is your dependencies probably doesn't change very often. So Veet kind of separates your code between your source code and your dependencies. Your source code probably changes every day when you work on it. But your dependency, once you install it, once your lock file is there, as long as your lock file didn't change, we can assume your dependencies did not change, right? Unless you want to manually edit it, but you can force validate the cache if you want to. But the idea is we use the lock file as sort of a cache freshness hint. So once we pre-bundle your dependency once, then we're good for until the next time you install something else.
It seems like, so, I mean, not that you want to, this is what Snowpack does too, right? They've been hot on this idea.
Yeah. So Snowpack had this, Snowpack version 1 was actually exactly that, something that converts CommonJS into ESM. So they turned it into a standalone thing called ES Install now, which is rollup based. So the early version of Veet did almost the same thing, we use Rollup as well because we already use Rollup for production, right? the upside is you only do this once every time your dependency cache invalidates. But if you have, say, like a huge project with some crazy dependencies like Material UI, you know, a whole UI framework, these UI frameworks typically have like hundreds of modules as well. It can take, you know, a couple of seconds to pre-bundle even. And so in my personal development, this was before V2, right? I was using V1, which was doing the pre-bundling with Rollup. And this is probably the only part that I felt like we should probably improve this because it's still like reminds you of this like bundling days where you have to wait for something to start up. It's just less often. So, but when it comes to pure bundling, especially when you're bundling something, most of these dependencies are already pure JavaScript. ES Build is just like, I'm already here. I can do it insanely fast, right? So, so it just came to me, oh, we're already using ES. So, I think I was probably the first person to use ES Build in a like front end in a dev server to transpile TypeScript on the fly. I actually opened the issue to ask for a standalone transform API from Evan Wallace so that I could use it in Vite. So after using it for just transforming individual modules, ES Build became a lot more mature in bundling bundling libraries. So once it had this capability of doing multi-entries, I realized, okay, like it already has the capability to do what I was previously doing with Rollup to pre-bundle the dependencies. So I started experimenting with it and it was able to completely switch the whole pre-bundling process to use ES Build under the hood. So that dramatically improved the startup speed.
Yeah, I bet.
Even with a code cache, typically, so I'm on an M1 and I was running the M1 optimized version of ES Build for a very long time. And I get huge projects that take like 30 seconds on an M1 Mac to pre-bundle with Rollup. Now with ES Build, it's like 1.5 seconds. Oof,
30x almost. So pre-bundling seems interesting, you know, like you get this dependency ready and then just leave it alone because you've already bundled it. So even though it's 1.5 seconds, you only incur it once, which is wild, right? But then there's also this, to me, a part of the story, and maybe I'm just wrong, but it seems like it, is that a lot or most of NPM like isn't ESM ready. It's like whoever wrote it isn't, they didn't write it in that way. So Something has to smurf it together to make it
ESM
ready.
Exactly. Yeah, that's another part of it. Yeah. So you need to convert all these wild formats into standard ESM. And it's actually really tough. Like, When I was testing this new pre-bundling stuff, like I literally get incompatibility reports every single day, and I think you know I kind of appreciate all the work you know tools like Webpack does in handling all these wildly contradicting usage of package formats. You know, we have all these non-standard fields in package.json like browser field, module field, JS next, and then now we have conditional exports. For the sake of it, like the community just can't seem to agree on how to actually use these fields. So it's like we come into these situations where this package expects these fields to work this way, and that package expects to work it that way. And there's only, you know, the tool can't accommodate both at the same time. And in those cases, we kind of like have to do some, either ask the user to alias it to the correct entry, or we are like, we have to have these internal hacks where like, say, one of the hacks we have to do is a package that has the browser field and the module field. Some packages ship ESM for both and expect the module field to work in Node and the browser field to work in the browser. Mm. And some packages, they ship UMD files in the browser field and they ship browser-oriented ESM in the module field.
Wow.
So the tool is like V has to basically make its best guess at what the package author actually means. And there's because these are not actual standards, like you can't tell people like, hey, you're just using it wrong. So it's kind of a wild west in how to define, you know, especially shipping a package that has, you know, multiple formats like UMD, CommonJS, ESM. And what makes it worse is like Node shipped a native ES module in support, right? So a lot of packages now like say, oh, we support ESM. But what they're actually doing is having this file that imports from CommonJS, then re-export everything as ESM.
You mean they didn't offer it that way? They just shipped it through two tools? To
and the reason for them to do that is because Node recommends it because it avoids a problem called dual package hazard. Which is essentially if you ship your ESM and CommonJS as separate copies of modules, and it's possible to in your application module graph to for someone to require your module, someone to import your module, and these would end up with different copies of your module.
Oh no.
And the way to avoid that is to make your ESM entry point just a proxy to your actual CommonJS copy.
Wow.
But that breaks compatibility with browser tooling because we expect if you are declaring your ESM, we expect you to be ESM all the way through instead of just proxying to CommonJS again. So, you know, there's all these wild things that I discovered while trying to make everything work.
Yeah, that sounds like throw your computer into a volcano kind of stuff to me. That's terrible. So what, I mean... Could we, I mean, you know this stuff really well, so I'd love to be like, here's our recommendation. If you publish something to ESM, do this because it's good for everybody. What is do this?
It's actually tough. I think you should probably start your package directly with conditional exports field. Since I believe that's, You know, the situation with module fields and browser fields is there are so many established conflicting usage that a lot of tools have. It's kind of Webpack has its own thing, Rollup has its own thing, and we're essentially relying on de facto implementations as reference points. But the exports, conditional exports field is something that is properly documented and spec'd in Node.js. So, this is something, you know, we have an opportunity to say if all future tooling converge on this, then we have this non-ambiguous way to figure out what you should resolve to. Unlike we are, you know, unlike in previously where every package ships like these, you know, main JS Next module, package, unpackage, browser, you know, all these fields. I mean, conditional exports doesn't make this any simpler. But at least it's a new, you know, opportunity to de-ambiguate all this stuff, I guess.
Is it the field that's just called exports in package.json?
Yes.
And you refer to it as conditional export?
Yeah, it should be just the exports field, yeah. Conditional exports is one of the features it provides.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, we've been messing with that. So that's interesting. And we don't really have any advice. Good luck. The advice is good luck.
Yeah, it's tough because shipping it correctly, especially if you have an existing project, adding exports field is sort of risky because it will probably break some existing tooling that expects to work in a certain way.
I guess if it works for you, though, maybe you can just be like, I don't know, then don't use Dave Carousel. Dave Carousel only. But isn't there a world where you write ESM, you ship ESM, and you just stop caring about anything that isn't ESM?
Yeah. I mean, if you're shipping pure browser-oriented libraries and you're like, I don't support anything that expects CommonJS for the browser, then yes. I would actually recommend that. You should just ship, you know, plain ESM. And then you have, you just tell them like, hey, I don't have CommonJS.
Yeah.
the problem is a lot of times your library probably, you know, with all these server rendering stuff around, people expect your library to be usable in Node.js. And Node.js kind of complicates the scene because, you know, it kind of supports ESM in the latest versions with a lot of gotchas. But, you know, in earlier versions, if people are stuck on, say, Node 12, they don't actually have proper ESM. And they'll be like, hey, you need to ship a common JS version of your lib for it to work in my server-side rendering projects running on Node 12. So it's a tough job for library authors to support all that stuff.
Do you think you're rounding the corner on supporting that stuff in Vite, or are you still like hitting those issues day to day?
I think we're pretty good now, since we're seeing all these people reporting migrating their existing projects to Vite without much problems. We still run into a few edge cases here and there, but it seems for the most common cases, it's working fine. ES Build handles both CommonJS and ES modules, and it allows mixing both. And it does a very decent job at that already, but you know, there are some really, really weird cases where like you, similar to how the case where you have a dependency, A, B, C, and B requires A and C imports A, both thinking they are requesting the same module, but like they're, one is importing it, one is requiring it, and sometimes it confuses ES Build. And yeah, things like that. But we found hacks, workarounds.
Do you have any if material design or like if ant design code in Vite?
Actually, not yet. I think I was able to remove most of them. Special case Babel for one case, and was able to remove it after I reported the request to ES Build, and it got fixed. I mean, it got shipped, nice. So I was able to remove that special condition. Yeah, but yeah, Babel. That was the thing I was talking about. Is Babel 7.13 added a different set of exports field to its Babel helpers package? Mm-hmm. You know, which broke a bunch of things and had to. They had to release like 7 or 6 like hot patches just to fix all this stuff.
Let's do the Babel thing for a moment, if you will. It seems like that was absolutely standard. And probably in 2019, literally every JavaScript project went through Babel, and probably most still do. But I don't know. To me, it seems like it's not like dramatically falling away, but maybe a little bit because of, you know, we're hearing from Google like, hey, stop transpiling so much of your like ES6.7 stuff. Just leave it alone. You know, stop messing with it. And then if you're really targeting pretty modern stuff, it's like, maybe I don't need to send it through Babel at all. And then, you know, but then people are like, yeah, but what about JSX or whatever? Like I have Babel do that. You know, what are the things remaining that we needed? And are its days numbered, or will it just be useful forever, or what's up?
I think Babel, the thing with Babel is it, because it's not a single purpose tool, right? It's a whole code transformation infrastructure. So people use it to do all kinds of different things like JSX, even TypeScript. You know, some use it to transpile for legacy browsers. Sometimes some people use it for using experimental syntax or macros that they write themselves, right? Mm. All these are different use cases. So if we separate them into three categories. One is standard standard transformations like JSX or TypeScript. These are spec'd. We all expect them to transpile to more or less the same thing. And tools like SWC or ES Build can already do this, right? So if we and can do it, you know, 20 to 30 times faster, maybe even more than Babel. So if you and then there's transpiling for legacy browsers. For transpiling legacy browsers, there's no point in doing it in development, right? Mm-hmm. Why would you, unless you are trying to test on an actual legacy browser, right? So you should avoid it as much as possible and only do it for production testing, right? And then there is macros or future syntax. So this is the part where I think Babel will still be very valuable, because I think, you know, the concept that especially front-end developers, they're more, you know, comfortable with working with compilers nowadays. So a lot of people are coming up with these ideas like, you know, just especially in CSS.js scenes, like people use Babel to do these crazy, you know, write CSS and JS, but like compile it into something different, extract it away, you know, or you can do things like stage three proposals. I want to use it. I want to use it now, but browsers don't support it. So these are, I think, still valid cases. But if you are only doing, say, JSX or TypeScript, and you are only transpiling for legacy browsers, then I believe you don't really need Babel in the future, because there are faster tools and there are better strategies to deal with this. And this is the default in Vite. So Vite is modern by default. There is no Babel by default. So you just write modern JavaScript. It works directly in your browser. And the baseline target for a Vite-built application is native ES module support. So if you just stick to, say, and we also transpile syntax down to ES 2015. So essentially, if you are just, unless you're using something that's can't not be that are, you know, features that are not simple syntax transforms, then you should just be good.
Does it leave your async await alone?
Yeah.
Does it leave your spreads alone? Yeah, that's probably, you know.
Yeah. So So you need to be aware of that. So spreads can be turned into syntax transforms. Say you inline a helper and then turn it into a call, which ES Build already does. So these are kind of covered. You do need to be a little aware, but it's much better than, say, you know, having to configure all these polyfills and stuff for no good reason.
And if you want to put Babel in, can you do it in Vite?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
But Vite does some other stuff, right? Like Vue, right? That's not...
Isn't that a Babel plugin? How do you turn a .vue file into whatever it turns into?
That's not a Babel plugin. So Vue has its own compiler called the SFC compiler, single file components compiler, right? Both Vue 2 and Vue 3 has a package that's dedicated for parsing and transforming single file components. So the Vite has a plugin system, which is inspired by Rollup. It's actually a superset of the Rollup plugin interface. So if you are writing a Vite plugin, if you already know how to write a Rollup plugin, you kind of already know how to write a Vite plugin. So there is the resolve ID, load, and transform. That's the three main hooks that you need to know, and you're good to go, right? So Vite plugin Vue is, in fact, just a port of Rollup plugin Vue with a bunch of Vite-specific tweaks to make hot module replacement work.
Oh, nice.
And then you do like source maps and stuff like that too, because when I open DevTools, I see the Vue file actually. I was like, wait a minute, how, you know?
Yeah, so we do ship source files as well.
That's pretty cool. For me, like the development experience is like, we talked about this a bit on the last show, but you know, it's been so long since I've been in a project that had working source maps, you know, so where you're like, oh, it's actually, I can see. And I feel like it's part of this tooling where, you know, the delta between what I'm loading on my, in my Vite app and then what is getting transpiled or code modded or whatever, that delta is very low. It's just like one file to one file.
Yeah. I think what makes source maps finicky in a lot of projects is just how long the build pipeline is. Like any step in between the transformations, there's like one tool that just forgets to return the source map or messes it up. Then it just breaks everything.
Yeah.
I don't know, like working with source maps, I think the biggest problem is source maps doesn't really have a very easy to understand, you know, explainer of how it works. It's kind of always this like really mysterious thing. And you always kind of have to do it with trial and error. Like major bundler authors, like I think Tobias, who work on Webpack, Evan Wallace, who work on ES Build, they all built their source map visualizer just to be able to figure it out how it works.
Yeah, you don't. So, it's not like you open DevTools and it won't even tell you like, oh, it looks like you're trying to load a source map, but you have the syntax wrong. it won't tell you. It's just not there. And then if there's something wrong with the source map, it's not like it says, oh, on line 12 of your source map, there's a syntax error. So we could only parse this part. It won't tell you shit. Sorry, I shouldn't say
that. Yeah. And as tooling authors, it's, you know, it's not pretty fun either. It's just the thing itself, you can't read it. It's like base 64. And like, well, it's a special format. Like you can't it's like humanly readable. It's not humanly readable. So you kind of have to build some tool to be able to understand, oh, I'm actually generating this line wrong. Like it's not something like when you're debugging, you can like put a debugger statement in there and figure out, oh, like I actually have this line offset by one. Like you can only trial and error this until it works.
It's nice that you get it because then at the end of the day, the DX is really good, right? Now you have this really nice map that maps to it. That seems like the story overall here. If I can make this really fast, the DX is good. If I can ship production projects that make really smart decisions for me and are tree shaken and bundled intelligently and whoever, what kind of magic happens, all my production story is good too. That's awesome. You know?
Yeah, I think that is what Vite, I guess that's why I call Vite a bit opinionated in the sense that it actually sort of packs in all these sort of recommendations or best practices that we kind of learned along the way in Vue CLI. And for typical users, we realize, okay, like you will most likely want this. So let's just provide it as the default. And I think that's what Parcel also does really well, right? The reason a lot of people likes Parcel is because it's opinionated and works out of the box. A lot of the stuff that you think, oh, I need, if I import CSS, it should do this. If I import TypeScript, it should do this. A lot of stuff just, you know, just works. And that's kind of the result if you're doing, say, with Webpack, right? People already kind of come, today's developers, they already come with kind of expectations because most of them started using Webpack with a higher level package tool like Create React App or Next.js, Nuxt.js, or Vue CLI. And a lot of these common conventions between these major higher level tooling or meta frameworks, people just nowadays, they take it for kind of granted. And in a lot of cases, we should make it just work without having to force everyone to say, okay, to get this working, you need to first install V, then these loaders, then write your config file like this, and then voila, you can have this basic project running, right? We don't want to force people to go through all that again. Because like we as a community, we kind of have gone through this all together and we're like, okay, this is where we're at now. Let's just sort of like bake it into the tool and make it, you know, work out of the box.
That's what makes it JavaScript in 2021, right? Like it's just a new set of stuff that we just want now. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by the makers of Axe Dev Tools. Literally, it's like a DevTools plugin you add to your browser, so that when you open the native DevTools, there's like an Axe tab there, and you can run tests. It's really good. I just did a video with Preeti from there on CSS Tricks, so go watch that if you haven't, because we really dig into all the possibilities there. Pretty amazing. They just launched Axe DevTools Pro. You can try it for free for 14 days. Otherwise, try it 20% off with promo code ShopTalk. What it unlocks for you is it makes that plugin way better. It has these things in it called intelligent guided tests, which you have to see. They're amazing accessibility things that you can test, but it has to walk you through some stuff because it has to ask you some questions and gain some insight to what's happening on your page, which is stuff that like a purely automated test isn't going to catch, but is super vital for the accessibility of a website. So you probably didn't set out to build an app that was purposely inaccessible. Like none of us do that. We're like, I'm going to make a crappy inaccessible site, but you probably did, you know, like I run it on my site and I'm like, whoa, there's some problems here. Oops, I guess I better fix those. You didn't set out for problems, but you still need to fix them. So the Axe DevTools Pro browser extension helps you find them. And you don't have to be an expert at all about accessibility. It's just that helpful. So start catching and squashing these accessibility issues as you code. Friends, don't let friends ship inaccessible code. Follow the link in the show notes or just go find Axe DevTools Pro and use the code SHOPTALK to get it.
And you're like providing plugins like Vite. Obviously you work on Vue. Like Vue is like a first party, or I guess maybe this is the perfect example of a second party thing, but it works with JSX. It works with React. You can kind of build these projects in it as well. It's not just limited to the Vue ecosystem. You're just a translation layer, as I'm understanding it, a roll-up translator on top of VS Build that is very, very fast and has a web server packed in, sort of.
It's sort of, yeah.
I'm getting too simple probably, but it's just, I don't know. I find it the, cause you know, Webpack was very useful for a very long time and still useful, but like you kind of just write your config, cross your fingers and pray to God you never have to change it again. and all this stuff happens kind of behind the scenes, and from the code you wrote dramatically changes. I mean, but now it just seems like, I don't know, a slimmer and a new way to
what are the chances you need to update your Vite config? Is it low? Is the goal to be like most projects don't need to touch it at all?
I would hope so. I think especially for I would say for 80% of projects, if you're just like common, you know, typical React or Vue project, your config file should be pretty good. I mean, the default config file should be pretty good. Like some of the stuff people will probably use is just like common aliases, these like, you know, setting the public path, you know, the base option. But these are straightforward. People already know what they do. Like some of the more crazy config file I've seen are people who like to write their own plugins, you know. People really have different ways of using stuff. Like early adopters, they, I don't know, they like to abuse the hell out of these tools. I've seen people report issues with like a simple project, but they wrote like 5 custom plugins to just so that they can get it the way they like. Some users are like that, but I believe for most users, it should be just a pretty sweet out of the box experience.
How about, I want to do that like the first 2 minutes with Vite thing. But I have a question about monorepos. Is it healthy there? Can you like, is the config cool that it will kind of reach up and out to another repo or another folder at a higher level? And is it cool with that?
It actually works with monorepos, right? So one of the limitations when we first started working on a native ESM dev server is we realized, okay, if it's just a simple HTTP server, you can only serve things inside your current directory, right? If you say import into a sibling package, yeah, how does it do that, right? But I mean, we figured it out. Like we do some sort of weird thing to rewrite your URL so that it's like, oh, the dev server knows you're actually requesting a file out of the root directory.
Oh.
So we are able to resolve and load
trickery with that module syntax too. I imagine it's similar to that, right? If you request from /@module, it does some fancy crap.
So if you request an out of root file, it gets turned into something like /@fs/absolute file.
Fancy.
Well, yeah, done. then the dev server knows, oh, this should be resolved from the file system, and it applies all the same transforms. We also do some smart heuristics so that we know, oh, this is a linked package in a monorepo instead of inside node modules. So we will not pre-bundle it because you probably expect it to work in its source code format. You may even edit it. So the common practice for that is if you have a monorepo where you have Vite in one of the packages, One of the packages is a Vite project, but it imports all these sibling packages as dependencies. You just alias all these packages to their source file instead of the built distribution file. So when you say import foo, which is a sibling package, you're in fact importing foo/source/index.ts or something, right?
Okay.
And then it'll just work like normal source file. So if you edit a sibling package, it even triggers hot module replacement.
Oh, that's so cool. So you don't even, you don't even need Lerna. It just...
Lerna does a lot of other things.
I know, but that's the one that makes the symlinks for like buddy packages. I mean, I use it just only for that. And it's like, it'd be cool to get rid of it.
I use it, I think people have used Vite with Yarn workspaces, with PMPM workspaces, and it kind of just works.
Just works. Yeah. Good. So, okay, first 2 minutes with Vite. Let's say it's a Vue project. You said it's parcel-like, so you make an index.html file. At the bottom of the body, there's a script source, and it says, ./script/index. Do you just write .vue right in the HTML? Like, in parcel, if you're writing SAS, you just make your link tag to a .scss file and it just knows what to do. So it makes some alternate version of your index.html file and puts it in a dist folder that's already been transpiled.
Yeah. So here's the smart part, right? We parse all these script tags in your HTML. Then we rewrite the inline script into a script source equals /HTML.js/proxy? Mm-hmm. Right. Then the server knows, okay, this is actually, so it actually, what it does is just moves this inline script into an actual ES module. Mm-hmm. And then apply the transform just as everything else. So yes, you can import .vue inside your HTML in the inline module script if you want to.
Inline module script. Wow, that's wild. Yeah, it knows what you're doing. And then you better remember to like import Vue itself too, otherwise, right?
Yeah, if you import from Vue, then it just knows it resolves to the Vue in your node modules.
Nice. And then there's a dist folder with an index.html file in it that's been all transmorgified. And but you don't even need to open that because your Vite server is already running, right? So you just hit the local host and
yeah. I think the goal that we're trying to do here is like, although there's a lot of magic going on under the hood, right? The experience is very akin to a simple HTTP server you're starting, right? Say in the early days when we're working locally, we're just like creating index.html, fire up a HTTP server, and then just like, refresh every time you save, and we're good, right? That's the early days of development. Mm-hmm. Like you edit some CSS, you refresh, edit CSS, you refresh. And everything's kind of snappy and fast because in those days, we don't do all these like crazy transpiling, bundling, and all the stuff. And kind of one of the goals, the personal goal for me with Vite is to bring that experience back so that like, when you want to start working on something, you just fire up a server with an index.html and everything kind of just flows from there.
Nice.
And I believe we can do that with Vite today, right?
JavaScript for sure will hot module reload because we covered that. That's the thing. But if you just put a link tag in the head of your HTML document that points to a CSS file and you're using no pre-process or anything on the CSS, will it also like, is there like intelligence? It knows like, they want a hot module reload that too. You wouldn't call it hot module reloaded. You just call it style injection, I guess. I don't know what you'd call it.
Yeah. It updates your CSS without reloading the page.
Very cool. Love that.
With link tags as well. Yes. And the link tags also work with pre-processors.
Oh, okay. Which ones do you get out of the box?
SAS, less stylus. PostCSS is included by default. So if you want to use PostCSS, just add a postcss.config.js and you're good to go. If you want to use SAS or less, just install SAS or less itself. There's no need to install a plugin for them.
Oh, cool. And then it knows by file extension. That's like your hint to it that tells you what to do.
Yeah, that's the conventional part. Like, so V is indeed a bit opinionated in how you expect these things to work. So if you import .scss, it should use SESS syntax. Also, if you import JS versus JSX, V insists that you separate them because otherwise we would have to guess JSX for all the JS files, which will, you know, require unnecessary transforms.
Okay.
I thought I saw you tweet about that. I thought that was like a bold decision, but B, it makes sense because JSX is so kind of fundamentally different from what it has to do. Like it incurs extra processes. So it just seems like, yeah, it should have its own extension.
Yeah. I just find the practice of putting non-standard syntax in a .js file problematic. It works if your whole organization, you know, assumes that. Like if you have a organization-wide, you know, tooling infrastructure that just assumes .js will contain non-standard syntax, then fine. Because, you know, you're Facebook, so your JS file probably always contains something non-standard. Flow, JSX, right? They put all that stuff in JS. But if you're just, you know, as a community ecosystem tool, we can't assume that because, you know, a lot of times we expect .js to just work directly in the browser without having to transpile it.
I'm on this thing right now where, you know, CSS modules is actually not a non-standard syntax. It's just what happens to it once it's imported does fancy stuff. But the syntax itself, for the most part, I think it has one or two little fancy crap things it does that's non-standard. But the file extension is often just .css. But I was on a next project and they're like, no, if you want CSS modules, you have to name it .module.css.
Ah, yeah. Otherwise, Feed does that too, actually.
Oh, yeah. Good. I like that. And I was like, oh, then I'll have to go back and change a bunch of old crap on my project. But I was like, I'm glad to because I think it's more clear. I think it's more obvious to people coming to the file. Like, oh, that's what that file is.
Yeah. And that's the part where I, you know, I always say it's opinionated because...
Because it's a good opinion.
We don't see, like, unless you have a really strong reason that, so a lot of times people will open requests, like, because I prefer to do it the other way. I'm like, so, but is it worth adding an option for it or making this whole thing configurable? Then if we make everything configurable, then we're just back to Webpack. Right? Yeah.
Well, and fundamentally, the whole point of file extensions is like to tell you what's in the file, like .html. This thing contains HTML. Like .js, this contains JavaScript. Like, but then you like throw in, oh, it's JavaScript, but you got to kind of fiddle with it to actually make it work. That's
I mean, there's a challenge in this because, you know, ES modules kind of brought this onto itself. Like, we have MJS, you know, JS and all that stuff. But, you know, I still think, like, you know, if you are shipping some code for front end, just let the extension be explicit about what it's doing in there. And so the tool can make, you know, if you just follow the simple convention, just name your extension properly, then the tool will handle most of the other stuff for you. I think that's a good compromise. That's a good trade-off.
Happy path. Go with it. That's what I like.
And so I want to talk, I know we're kind of running out of time here. I want to talk about Vue 3 because that's something that has launched since the last time we talked, but, Is Vite starting to make its way into the Vue ecosystem? I think like ViewPress was, or you're working on a version with a ViewPress with it, or will Nuxt ever get it?
Yeah. So ViewPress is what is this like ViewPress alternative built on top of Vite. In fact, I built ViewPress and Vite almost kind of in parallel because one of the big driving factors for me to work on Vite was I was working on these docs, and I was fed up with how slow ViewPress was, which was Webpack based. And I'm like, if I can just swap this with Vite, my life would be so much better. So I built ViewPress, and I'm pretty happy with it. If you're, you know, writing new documentation, you should definitely check it out. It's almost has all the things that ViewPress can do, but it's lighter, faster, you know, produces smaller sites. You know, obviously it's simpler. It doesn't have plugins or any of that stuff, but it's pretty flexible. And for the next theme already has all these crazy experimental integrations. So they made this bundler part swappable. So they already shipped something that allows you to use Vite in Nuxt too. They also have, wow. They also already showed me an experimental version of Nuxt 3 running on Vite. I think there are some trade-offs involved in there because Nuxt makes certain assumptions about how the server-side stuff works. And Vite actually ships its own server-side rendering support. I should probably mention this, but like Vite as a scope, it also has this like server rendering capability that allows you to load your, because you are now writing ES modules and all these like view files, you know, JSX stuff. And if you expect them to work in Node for server-side rendering, typically nowadays is with Webpack, you have to like bundle Webpack for client, bundle for server. Then you need to like rebundle both whenever you make a change. So Vite does this thing by transforming your client-oriented modules on the fly, load them in Node.js in memory, maintain this graph, and then do this like in-memory replacement, kind of like hot module replacement directly in Node. So this whole thing was, this is like what Rich Harris came up with in his exploration for SvelteKit. So I felt that's a good solution to improve the DX for server-side rendering related projects. So I implemented it in Vite, and now Rich is moving SvelteKit to be built on top of Vite. So,
oh, wow. Awesome.
Yeah. So I think that's some really cool collaborations that's going on here. Rich actually already submitted a few PRs to fix some server-side rendering related stuff in Vite as well. So I expected to see some cool stuff coming out of the Svelte team as well.
Nice.
Yeah, that's cool that it could, I don't know, it could like support now two frameworks or two different kind of
The server-side rendering is a pretty generic implementation. It works with React, Vue, Svelte, or other stuff. Like, I know like Solid.js is also doing a Vite-based template. I mean, if you want to get preact server rendering in there, it probably will work too. I think it's a good, it's just something that I wanted myself, right? Just a no hassle server rendering environment that's fast. And at the same time, we managed to make it framework agnostic, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I know we're kind of at time.
Yeah, we have 30 seconds left. Let's talk about web components.
Do they work? Anyway, I do have web component questions, so I'll just gently throw those in the trash right now. So Vue 3 is out. People should use it. I guess that's what you would say, Evan. Is that right? High level?
Yeah. If you're starting new projects, then by all means, go for Vue 3. It's just smaller, faster. You get better TypeScript support. And and you get to play with some of the experimental stuff that we've been brewing, like script setup with Composition API. We haven't really heavily publicized it yet, but you know, some early adopters have been running it in production, and they are super happy with it.
I remember there was an idea for it was experimental in Vue at one point. And then I became really bullish on the idea, although it's gone nowhere. Which is the idea that all state should be mapped to CSS properties. Like you shouldn't have to ask for that to happen. Any state that you declare should just be a CSS property. Custom property.
That's actually a thing. There's an RFC for it. So inside a single file component in the style section, you can use. I need to double check, but I think we add this special vbind thing in your CSS, so you can just bind state. Yeah, it already works. So you can try it out in a Vite project. If you start a Vite Vue project, it already works. I mean, it's marked as experimental, but it does work.
Sweet. I think that's a good idea.
Well, cool. Oh, yeah, we'll send it here. Thank you, Evan, so much for coming on the show. For people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
yeah, you can. There's a supporting view page on our website where you can learn all about the sponsor info, or you can find me on GitHub. I have GitHub sponsors. I'm also on Patreon, or Vue has an open collective, and then we have all these team members who also have their own GitHub sponsors. So if you use one of their projects and you think it helps you, you know, please consider donating, supporting them as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to start our favorite up. That's how people find out about our show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And we have a Patreon too, patreon.com/Shop Talk Show. And join the Discord. That gets you access to the Discord, which is popping off. So thank you, Chris. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
That's it. ChopTalkShow.com.